All right. Well, it's great to be with you guys this morning. I'm excited to be back with you. My name is Tyler Bacher. I'm the high school lead here at New Hope Church. Let me start by apologizing to this little section right here. I got some pictures. There's some prompts and stuff. So I'm sorry. We thought this would be there. It wasn't, you know? But it's never too late to shift over. It's never too late to meet new friends. If you're like, oh man, that picture did seem cool. I want to see the next one. Feel free at any time to move that way. But today is kind of a fun little bit of overlap, because this year on Wednesdays, the high school students and I have been working through the book of Matthew. We've been looking at the life of Jesus, who he was, what he taught, what he did, and his disciples, those boys, many of them high school aged, who just were trying to soak up as much as they could of what their rabbi had to say. They wanted to become just like him, even when he confused them and surprised them at basically every turn. Anyway, this happened to kind of all line up in such a way that we got to Matthew 24 and 25, just as Pastor Matthew got to this series too, entirely unplanned. And in my experience, whenever this happens, when there's kind of this double up where it's like you hit this passage, you hit this passage, you hit this passage, it seems like God's trying to tell us something that we need to take note of. So getting back to setting up today's passage, a through line that we've been hitting throughout this year with the high schoolers is the initial audience of the book of Matthew, who the book, the gospel, was written to, which seems, for Matthew, primarily Jewish Christians in the back half of the first century. And let me tell you, they are either in the middle of what seems like the end of the world or just on the other side of it, entirely shell-shocked. If the book of Matthew is written sometime between 60 and 80 AD, the audience is going through it. They are undergoing intense, true-blooded persecution. Most of the apostles, those initial disciples, are martyred in this time, many of which were crucified. So you go from having most of the people who were right by Jesus this whole way to just none of them all at once. And then, if that wasn't enough, coming off the heels of a devastating famine around 46 AD that we see in the book of Acts, we see that there are a variety of earthquakes that happen in the region, with one truly terrible one happening in 61 AD, which leveled multiple ancient cities, many of them with Jewish Christians in it. All the while, as this is all happening, the Romans keep finding ways to put the boot down just a little harder on them all the time. Although things weren't going too well for the Romans either, the ancient historian Tacitus records that around this time, four emperors were killed by the sword, three civil wars occurred, there were a bunch of other foreign wars that were happening at the same time, and in the brief moments of peace that they had, it was still bad. It was still a mess. That kind of sounds like the end of the world, doesn't it? If you open up your newspaper or you start scrolling Twitter and all these things are trending, there's an earthquake and a famine and a bunch of people just got martyred and, the emperor died again. You'd be like, what is happening? But don't worry, it gets worse. Because in 66 AD, the Jewish people finally had enough of Roman cruelty and decided to rebel. And they were surprisingly successful. They drove Rome out for a moment. But by 70 AD, Rome had pushed back in and laid siege to Jerusalem. They demolished the temple. They decimated Jerusalem. Out of everything you see, there should be a picture up there, but out of everything that you see kind of in that replica that you could see if you go to Jerusalem now, out of all of that, three towers remained. Everything else was destroyed. Ancient historian Josephus says that 1 million Jews were killed and 100,000 were taken as slaves during the siege of Jerusalem. So, in one final act, desperate act, the most extreme zealots, like a Jewish faction who are really intent on killing Romans, they run and gather at Masada. Now, Masada is an incredible place. You'll see it up there. To get to the ruins today, most people need to take a cable car from the bottom to the top. Now, the cable car was broken the day we were there, hence the view from the bottom, but you get the idea. But in order to get there in the past, when there wasn't a cable car, the only way was this winding trail that cut up the side that only you could go single file and that's it. Death to the side, you're hugging the wall just a little bit. And so this is where those last Jewish rebels circled the wagons, hoping beyond hope that somebody would come and that they could band together and do something yet against Rome. This lasted for 3 years. All the while, Rome slowly built the siege ramp to the top. Eventually, the Romans got there. They broke in, and they were shocked because everyone was dead. Realizing that no one was coming, and with the Romans on their doorstep, the rebels had decided it was better for them to die by their own hand. So as I said before, this is the end of the world for Matthew's audience. They are living in it, and they've got some questions. Was this what God had wanted for his people? Was this their end, to take up arms, to fight back, to defend themselves, and nearly be stamped out of existence? Or had he wanted something else? What was he calling his people to do in the face of what seemed like the end of the world as they knew it? Our passage gets that to that today, but in order to appreciate it, we gotta do a little bit more storytelling. We have to jump back to the first Palm Sunday, which is 40 years before this point. Masada is like 73 AD. We're going back to Jesus 40 years earlier. We know the story well. We just talked about it a few weeks ago. Jesus rides into Jerusalem on the donkey. And time for some group participation. There's gonna be some of that this morning. I want you to shout it out. What were the people waving? Palm branches, that's right. Does anyone know, maybe some high schoolers who've been listening, does anyone know what the palm branches represented? That's all right, I give you a pass. It meant zealots. It represented the zealots. It represented revolution. The palm branch was the sign of the zealots. These people are waving palm branches and yelling, "Save us!" And by that, they mean for Jesus to become their king that saves them from Rome, that finally ignites the powder keg and starts revolution. An important note, though, before we go on, we have every indication that the disciples, Jesus' boys, thought that this is what Jesus was going to do, too. All the way to Jerusalem from Caesarea Philippi, Jesus is blowing their minds, saying, "I'm not going to go overthrow Rome. I'm going to go serve and die." And it still hasn't quite sunk in yet for them. But Jesus, going back to him, at the sight of all these people calling for revolution, waving their palm branches, he weeps. He says in Luke, "If only you had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes." This is the divergence. The people think that God is going to help them throw off Rome, give them military victory, help them finally crush their enemies. But Jesus seems to have something else in mind, which is why Jesus shocks everyone when the first thing he does isn't start a revolution against Rome, but against their own temple. He goes to the temple and flips tables and calls it corrupt. He says that this was to be a house of prayer, but the wildly corrupt priests had made it a den of thieves. They took advantage of the poor. They pushed the outsiders further out. They killed to keep power. In fact, they do that to Jesus in just a few days. They didn't love God. They didn't love their neighbor. And Jesus is done with it. But if we remember the boys in tow, I think they're shocked. They're still thinking revolution time. Like, he's been saying some crazy stuff. But like, we know what's going to happen here until they get into that temple and Jesus starts doing this. They don't really know what's going on anymore. And then Jesus has the audacity to come back the next day, and obviously some people, some powerful people, have some questions, and he shuts down everyone who opposes him. They say, "Who do you think you are?" And he says, "The Messiah, who is God, who has come to bring judgment," and then tears apart the religious establishment of the day. If there's ever been a mic drop, it's here. And let me tell you, I'm reading into this. The boys are tilting. The boys are freaking out. They're like, they truly don't know what's going on at this point. Like, they're like, he actually is going to get himself killed. And us too. So on the way out, they're kind of like filing back out into the countryside. They look at Jesus, and you can almost hear the exasperation in their voice when they're like, "But do you see all these things?" As they wave like wildly at like the temple and everything that surrounds them. Like, "Jesus, do you see this?" And to be fair, what they were seeing was incredible. Herod, the guy who had tried to kill Jesus as a baby, was also known for building crazy things. He was the one who had built Masada, a fortress on top of an impenetrable plateau. He built the Herodium, which was a mountain, big hill. Let's say big hill. But there had been flat land, and then put a fortress on top of that. This dude is the definition of extra. That's all he ever did. And he built the temple just as extravagantly. Like, to give a better sense of scale, this is from the outer wall of that replica that we saw. If you look at that big block that's at the bottom there, that is 4 million pounds. It's crazy. No one knows how Herod built the temple. It's kind of like up there with the pyramids in terms of like, how could you do that with what you had? It's an engineering marvel. But it's also basically where everything that mattered most to the Jewish people resided. God was supposed to dwell with them there. All of the religious, everything was there. Jesus, just look at this thing. Can you really condemn it? And Jesus says, it's all coming down. Now imagine being the boys hearing this. Like, Jesus has come and condemned it as corrupt, but now he's saying, it's going to be destroyed? Oh, man. They're tilting. Time for a little bit more audience participation, though. I want you to, if you heard me a few weeks ago, you know what's coming. I want you to find a neighbor, probably not a relative if you can help it. Find a neighbor, introduce yourself, make sure nobody's left out, and I want you to answer this question briefly with them. You might have to move. What is the most amazing, man-made marvel that you have seen? What is the most amazing, thing that you have seen that man has built? Find a friend, talk about that for a minute, and then we'll come back together. You'll have a chance to talk later, I promise. I want to hear your answers, though. A little bit more group participation. I want to hear your answers. On the count of three, I want you to yell out the most incredible man-made wonder you've ever seen. All right, 1, 2, 3. I bet those are awesome. I heard all of them, I promise. Now, imagine as you're seeing this for the first time, eyes welling up, man, we can accomplish great things. And the tour guide comes up behind you and is like, bummer it's going away. Bummer it's coming down. Good thing you saw it before it all explodes. I don't think you take that very well. That might freak you out a little bit. And you better believe that those boys were freaked out too. This is coming down? So now imagine them walking behind Jesus up the Mount of Olives, all looking at each other like, you ask him. No, you ask him. He listened to you last time. You ask him. Finally, they get up to the Mount of Olives. And we don't know which boy, but one of them gets up the courage to say, dude, what are you talking about? When is this going down? When is our world ending? Because if the temple's destroyed, that's the end of the world for them. That means things have gone horribly wrong. And so Jesus starts telling them about their immediate future, what the boys are about to experience. And you better believe that hung over them for the rest of their lives. And then finally catches us up to our passage today. A little bit of legwork to get there. Pastor Matthew has been looking at the beginning of Jesus' response to those boys the last few weeks. Just as a reminder, here's what Jesus starts with in response, starting in Matthew 24, verse 4. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginnings of the birth pains." Now, before we get to our passage, doesn't that sound a little familiar? Kind of like we were just talking about before. What the boys are walking into for the rest of their lives. Jesus continues in verses 9 through 13, our passage for today. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. And at that time, many will turn away from the faith and betray and hate each other. Many false prophets will appear and deceive the people. Because of the increase in wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but the one who stands firm until the end will be saved. Now I want to just take a time out for a second, because this sounds similar to the ending at Masada. The rebels at Masada died out. The boys are going to apparently go die. Like, is this the end for God's people? Do they all just go die in different ways? What's the difference? Well, let's walk back through it. Jesus confirms that many of the boys would be persecuted to death at the end of their life. And we know that that came to pass. And along the way, it would have felt like all the nations hated them. Rome, which engulfed them, hated them. Not just because they wouldn't worship Caesar, but because their entire way of life was counter to the way the Romans lived. Their whole social structure was challenged by the fact that these annoying Christians existed. And then to go to their own Jewish people, at the very least like the priests and the people who would follow them, they hated them too, because the disciples proclaimed that Jesus was right, that he was the king, that he was God, and in your corruption you killed him. You don't make friends that way. So the world that surrounded them hated them. And in this pressure cooker that we talked about before of wars and wars and wars and political unrest and natural disasters and famine and persecution and hatred, there will be an unbelievably difficult pressure to stop following Jesus, to give up on faith holistically. Wouldn't it be easier to handle this mess if everyone didn't hate you? Wouldn't it be easier to find food if you weren't also like threatened with death? Hey, let's bring it to our context for just a minute. Have you ever been stuck with people in a van for a long time? Or like had a small apartment with a bunch of roommates, or maybe a dorm room? You're starting to think of like the dynamics that are at play here, maybe on a smaller level. Like everyone starts off on their best foot, right? Like we're all gonna have a great time as friends. But spend a few hours in the van, or a couple months in the dorm room, or in the apartment, and all of a sudden, we found reasons to kill each other. Like, maybe this is just a guy thing. Smells develop. You can ask my district blitz leaders about that. Or maybe you realize that someone's a neat freak, or someone's a control freak, or someone has people over at all hours of the night. And these little things start building on you and building on you and building on you. And even in these low-pressure situations, relatively, we find reasons to hate each other. Now imagine you're in the pressure cooker of first century Palestine, when any of you could die at any moment, when food is scarce, when there are real founded concerns about the state of the world. How easy would it be just to hate and betray each other and tear each other down in that moment? Alternatively, how appealing would it be to listen to a false prophet who says, "Hey, I heard from God, time to fight the Romans." Or, "Hey, I heard from God, you can just be a Roman. Like, you can just become like them. It's fine. They're good." So we get to verses 12 and 13, which, just to remind us, say, "Because of the increase in wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm until the end will be saved." Because of everything that we described, the love of most will grow cold. Jew, Roman, Christian, whoever, the temptation for everyone is to let love die and look out for themselves. Circle the wagons, defend yourself, like give in to the fear and anxieties of this world and just make sure as best you can that you'll be okay. But Jesus says, stand firm and be saved. The opposite of letting your love grow cold is standing firm. What does that mean? Does that just mean like keep proclaiming Jesus, keep saying the thing? Is that the full alternative to letting our love grow cold? I think later in Matthew 25, we might actually get a clue. As Jesus continues this discussion about the boys' future, he eventually starts telling parables about judgment. And in this part that we're getting to, it envisions him as the king passing judgment on all things. The king says in Matthew 25, 34 through 40, "Come, "You who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. And I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" And the king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whenever you did this for one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you did it for me." He goes on to kind of reverse this idea, to condemn those who didn't do these things. So set aside for a minute like questions that might arise from that about like justification or judgment or whatever. Catch the main thrust. Actually, find your friend again. This is a moment to talk to each other. Look at the things in this passage that Jesus commends, the things that Jesus wants us to do. What do they all have in common? That's the question. Look at these things. What do they have in common? Go talk to your friend for just a minute. We're going to come back up here. We'll have a time to talk at the end, I promise. I think the best way, I'm sure you summarized it well too. I think the way that I would summarize or categorize what Jesus is talking about here, we all might say, is to love your neighbor. And this is what keeping love alive looks like. This is what standing firm looks like. This is what matters to God and what he calls his people towards. This is what the righteous do. This is what people who follow Jesus do. And this is what we're tempted to let go of when everything starts going sideways. So Jesus says to the boys, listen, all this unimaginable pain is coming for you and the world and your loved ones. Even so, you follow me. You keep following me. And even in the face of death, the boys are called to proclaim Jesus and be like Jesus in the world. And if they do that, the passage says next week that the good news of the kingdom of God will go into the world. And spoilers, it did. They told the world who Jesus was. They proclaimed him from the rooftops. They stood in front of everybody, even the most important people in the world who held their lives in their hands, and they proclaimed Jesus. And they fed the poor, and they cared for the sick. And the early Christians that came alongside them saved infants deemed undesirable by the Romans and left to die of exposure by raising them themselves. They recognized as valuable all the people Rome didn't care about. They worked to welcome the stranger into the family of God. And through all of that and more, the good news of the kingdom of God and the beginning of the actualization of that spread. I was kind of moved this week. When I was preparing for this, thinking about how these boys, who are as old as my high school students, take this news. They hear this news. They hear how the story ends in a way. They get kind of some of the worst news imaginable. And to be fair, like the next few days for them are rough, right? Like they, you know, Jesus dies, they all freak out. Like we know that. But when they saw their risen king and the Spirit came upon them, they never stopped. Facing all the evil of their day, they never stopped proclaiming Jesus and being like him as best as they could. They brought themselves and countless others to do the same. They did the thing. Those boys did it. And they gave everything for it. Students in here, this is for you for a minute. You're never too young to become like Jesus. To proclaim him to our world, to be him in our world, that is your call too. And you can do it just as much as I can, or as your parents can, or as your grandparents can, as anyone in this room can. That is your call too. It was called to those boys. And back to those boys, the day did come when they would die. They were older men by this point. And all but John suffered a horrible death. John didn't have it easy either. But their deaths couldn't be further from what happened at Masada, where the rebels at Masada had fought and lost and died in defiance but hopelessness. The boys died trusting that the kingdom was going forth, that God was at work in our world, drawing it to himself, preparing to make all things right at the end of all things. Whereas Masada had died in hopelessness, they had a great hope. They had fought the good fight. They had finished the race. They had kept the faith. Their love hadn't grown cold, so that the love of God could go forth and never be stopped. That was Jesus' call to his boys. That was the call to the original audience in Matthew. That is the call to us today. Which brings us to today. What do we take away from Jesus' teaching and the example of his boys? Well, our circumstances are very different, but the baseline pressures we're talking about push on us too. There are things in this world that make us nervous. People who hurt us, or groups of people who don't seem like they'd like us very much. Maybe it feels like the shoe's about to drop all the time when we like look at the news. What will we eat? What will we wear? Will the kids be all right? Like, all these things are pushing on us all the time. And those pressures and more will push us towards hating each other. It's so easy for our response to the wickedness of this world to be to let our love grow cold. It's so easy for our response when even anything starts going sideways in the world to like metaphorically run to Masada. Like, circle the wagons, defend yourself, defend God, as though he needs defending. Look after your own needs first. It's dangerous out there. That will always be a path in front of us to succumb, to give up on the ways of Jesus. Like, those ways worked then, but this is now. Like, we're too divided, or the stakes are too high, or we have to win now, otherwise we risk losing everything. Something else hyperbolic. But Jesus called his disciples through the ages to stand firm, to follow him and his ways. Don't let your love grow cold. Proclaim Jesus to our world. Be like Jesus in our world. Love God, love your neighbor. Yes, now, I want to sit here for a second, because our circumstances are a little bit different from first century Christians and other Christians around the world today. Mainly that, like, we in this room, at least not likely, we aren't being persecuted like they were. Let's be conscientious and careful about how we use that term, persecution. Like, we all suffer. And let me affirm that. We all suffer. Terrible things happen in this world, and it hurts us. Our health fails, and it hurts us. People say mean things to us or about us, and it hurts us. It might feel like there are people who don't want us to exist, and that hurts. And all those things and more hurt. That pain is real. I wish we didn't have to experience it. I look forward to the day when suffering ceases. But the persecution that Jesus is talking about is like threats of death. Threats of violence, threats that the resources you need to survive will be taken from you. There are many followers of Jesus in this world right now today who experience those stakes. We are not those people. We are not the persecuted church. We suffer. Affirm that. We suffer, but we are not persecuted. But even if we were, the call is still the same. The drumbeat is still the same. Proclaim Jesus and be like him in the world. Love God and love your neighbor. It hurts when someone says something mean to us, but our response is to love God and love our neighbor. It hurts when a whole group of people seems to be really mad at us. Our response? We love God. We love our neighbor. It hurts when terrible things happen in this world and we're scared about the future. Our response to that? We love God. We love our neighbor. It would be terrifying to be threatened with violence. What's our response to that? We love God and we love our neighbor. You better believe the boys had some sleepless nights thinking about the prospect of being crucified. What did they do? They loved God and they loved their neighbor. That is our call. That is our charge. That is our end, no matter what. If it's just a Tuesday or it seems like the world is ending around us, We love God and we love our neighbor. And that sounds really hard. And it is. In fact, it's impossible for us to pull something like that off on our own. But here is the best news of all. We serve a risen King Jesus who beat death, the powers of darkness, and the evil that so ensnares us, who loved us so much that he would die for us, who promises to raise us to new life too and make all things in our world new and be with us every step along the way till then. And he's given us the Spirit to be with us, to indwell us, to empower us to become something that we could not ourselves, to do things we could never do on our own. Through its power in our lives, we are shaped to become like Jesus, to love him and be him in our world. And when we do, we can trust that the kingdom of God goes forth, that God is on the move, working in our midst and in the world, that the way we bring the goodness of Jesus' kingdom and reign into our world is, in fact, to be like him. Yes. Loving God, loving neighbor, no matter what the world throws at us. So, you've made some friends by now. I want you to take a few minutes to kind of gather with them before Pastor Harry comes up to close us. There will be a couple prompts on the screen kind of processing what we talked about today. Or just shoot the breeze. I don't really care. Or if you think you need to pray with each other, that's fine too. Use these next few minutes however you see fit. But take that time, find that neighbor, speak with them, and then Harry will come up to close us.